Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how we, as a collective civilization, I feel, are moving into new realities, new possibilities. And nothing is more central to that evolution than the idea of contact, the idea of extraterrestrial contact. And in honor of that, there's going to be 4 days in the Joshua Tree Desert coming up the end of May, May 29th to June 1st, where we're going to be featuring the best, the latest researchers in the field of ufology. And tonight is someone who's one of the organizers of that event. He's one of the founders of a new paradigm in the world, the founder of the Whole Life Expo, Whole Life Times. Paul Andrews, thanks for being on the show tonight.
Alan, thanks for having me. It's great to hear from you.
Yes, and you know, as I was saying right before the show, I'm really excited about what's coming up in Joshua Tree, and you said there's so much to talk about. So where should we start?
Oh my God. Well, there's just so much, and it's like new things are being added every day. But let's start with the fact that we have 46 different speakers. I feel the top people in the UFO field, all together, all in one place, all at one time, in what is considered to be, at least here in California, the largest UFO hotspot that's been documented. And I say this, Alan, because there's activity that's been present in this spot, documented going back to the early 1940s. When George Van Tassel held the very first UFO conventions in North America. And where did he choose to hold them? He chose to hold them in Joshua Tree. And it's because in Joshua Tree there's a long history of sightings. All the people who live there or have lived there for a long period of time will almost all to the man tell you, or woman, that they have had some sort of contact or sighting or experience in their lifetime living in the greater Joshua Tree area. And as you know, Alan, Joshua Tree, along with Mount Shasta in California, are the two yin and yang power spots on the West Coast.
Right. And, you know, I heard in the 50s there were up to 20,000 people that would gather out there at that place that George Van Tassel has near the Integratron at Giant Rock. And it was a huge phenomena. And now, here, about 60, 70 years later, there's this resurgence of awareness in the UFO situation. But
that's true, Alan. Everything that you've said is true. And Van Tassel, did, of course, build this structure called the Integratron, which was built to harness, non-physical energies that were healing and empowering all at the same time. And so he chose that spot because, like the founder of the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, which is where the event is going to be, they had made a determination in their minds and in their experience that the veil between the physical and the non-physical was very thin at that point. And I think that that is one of the reasons. It may be a geomantic reason, we're not really sure, but it is a documented fact that this is a high-energy, spiritually empowered sighting area that has been a magnet for extraterrestrial activity, I believe, going back hundreds, perhaps even thousands of years.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what I think makes this conference so important is that there's a growing awareness that this is a fact, that there are extraterrestrial sightings. This is a situation that's not going away. You know, the papers, the mainstream may laugh at it, but it keeps coming back and coming back. And more people are coming forward at times when they wouldn't talk to anyone else, saying, yes, I've had a sighting, yes, I've had an experience. So what this conference does, it's not the speakers, which are incredible, but it's the people that are coming there that also make this event so amazing.
It is. They're a remarkable group of people that are coming, Alan, and they're coming from all over the country. In fact, all over North America. And, you know, I've done a lot of events in my life, but I've never done anything like this. And, you know, when I'm there at the event, speaking with these people, sharing their experiences, it's at once profound and uplifting for me and gratifying in a way to be able to have so many talented researchers and speakers who can validate their experiences. And I think one of the reasons that people come there, Alan, is that they don't want to feel alone. They don't want to be feel isolated or ridiculed or diminished in some way for having shared their experience. And I can tell you from, you know, having been in this field for a long time that there are a lot of people who have had experiences. And, you know, it's one thing for an adult, you know, say 25 to 75, to have had an experience and share it. It's an entirely different thing to talk to a 7, 8, 9-year-old child who's had an experience, who's not selling a book, who's not trying to get attention, who's not looking to get on television or the radio, but just wants to share honestly and openly what their experience has been and what's happened to them. And so I do agree with you that there is an increasing awareness about this in the country. I think there's a recent poll that was taken that showed that I believe it's slightly less than 50% of the people in America believe that there is something to this phenomenon and that they aren't being given the entire truth by our own government. And so that leads us into the question of why? Why? Why isn't the government talking to people about this? Why isn't there more information coming from the government? You know, this is part of what we try to address in the show, Alan. We try to tackle these really large questions of what's going on here. You know, what's really going on here?
Well, that's why I think bringing together this set of researchers to look at this UFO situation, because it's a complex situation. It's not like, yeah, they're out there, so what? There's levels and levels of secrecy and cover-up and disclosure. And who's coming to this conference are people who really dedicated their life to this awareness. People like Stephen Bassett, who lobbies in Washington, goes to Congress, meets with Congress men and women and say, we have a situation here. Linda Moulton Howe, who's done, you know, 30 to 40 years of up-close research in the fields with cattle mutilations and crop circles. Eric Von Daniken, who really is the godfather of the whole movement, I would say, with his Chariots of the Gods. I mean, these are people that take this subject very, very seriously and are committed to this, are committed to, really, it's about the truth. I mean, you're even having Stanton Friedman this year. Stanton Friedman single-handedly resurrected the Roswell situation. Without Stanton Friedman, no one would have heard of Roswell. And so everyone there is a sort of piece of this fabric that is awakening people to, and I think it's a higher consciousness. Yes, it's ETs. There's no doubt in my mind there's something going on here that we're not being told.
Well, and, Alan, I don't think there's any question about that. And I think that what people need to realize is that this is a multidisciplined subject area. It's not just about sighting craft. It's not just about encounters with aliens. It's not just about sightings in the night sky. It goes much, much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And one of the people, you mentioned Eric Von Daniken, who, yes, we consider to be the godfather of the ancient alien movement. But you've also got people like Zechariah Sitchin, who, in searching for his roots, wrote a 13-book series about his thesis of ancient aliens, you know, dating back into the Sumerian times in Mesopotamia. And he based his writings, now we're talking about 13 books here, he based his writings on clay tablets that were unearthed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and as recently as last year, hundreds of thousands of them, which tell a story. And basically the story is aliens came to Mesopotamia. They were searching for valuable minerals. They formed a colony. They realized that they needed, I hate to say this, but slave labor to do a lot of the menial work that they needed to have done. And so they took some of the primitive life forms that were on Earth, and they hybridized them with their own DNA and created essentially what has become us as the human race. And so, you know, one of the theses of ancient aliens is that we are, in fact, a product of the so-called gods, the Anunnaki. And that is a discipline that I think needs to be thoroughly vetted, thoroughly researched, and brought to light. I believe that a lot of the most powerful and wealthy people in this nation know what I call the hidden history. And we have to ask ourselves, why isn't this history being brought forward? It's so well documented in so many different countries by so many different people. Why isn't the hidden history being brought forward? We have to ask ourselves that, Alan. Don't you agree?
Oh, that is a major question, and it will be addressed. I mean, I actually helped produce a movie called The Hidden Hand, which we should show at Joshua Tree one year, because it talks about this hidden history and why we're not being told, because it upsets religious factions, political factions, the whole energy economy. I mean, this is things that one of the people that will be there that talks about this is Richard Dolan. He goes into deeper and deeper levels of why we're not being told this, because it upsets everything that this culture is built upon. It upsets the lies, the charades that we've been told by government about the way things are, government and religion and educational institutions. It upsets everything, which is okay. It needs to be upset, because obviously it's not working the way it is. We're seeing the collapse of many of these institutions that no longer serve us. And I think what will really pull it apart is this awareness coming forward in an even bigger way. Don't you think that is part of it?
I think that is part of it. I think that a lot of there was technology back then, ancient technology, and a lot of this has been documented and discussed on the television show Ancient Aliens, which is produced by Giorgio Tsoukalos, who is one of our keynote speakers at Contact. And they talk about a lot of the scientific advances that were brought here by the Anunnaki, and honestly, the atomic bomb being one of them, and how what's happening today is that we're just really re-remembering or rediscovering a lot of this ancient technology, and it's being brought to bear on our civilization. I mean, there are a lot of people who feel that there was technology taken out of the downcraft in Roswell and fed back into American industry. And in fact, there was a book written about that by Colonel Philip Corso, co-written by Bill Burns, and that talked about that very process. And, you know, as I watch different things going on today, there's a campaign, you know, going on right now to actively debunk that thesis, even though this guy was a high-ranking officer, and it was his life's mission to take this down technology and feed it into American industry. He wrote a book about it. He did a videotape about it. But in spite of all this evidence, you know, and all this testimony right before he died, you know, people are still trying to debunk that. I do believe that one of the reasons that that our military and our government has wanted to keep this quiet, keep it classified, keep it secret, top secret, is because of this technology that has been recovered from a lot of these down craft, in that there's been numerous advances, particularly in the electronics field, many different fields. But I think that from a weapons-based perspective, from a advanced technology perspective, from a military perspective, there is, you know, some motivation for wanting to keep this quiet. And in fact, I've spoken to some people, I can't name any names here, but in the military, who've told me that there's a special branch of the services that is on alert all the time. And whenever there's a crash or a sighting or a downing anywhere around the world, they hop into a supersonic jet and go down there and try to be the first to recover whatever technology they can from that crash.
Well, so, well, you know, that's interesting, because at the citizens' hearings for disclosure that Stephen Bassett put together in Washington in 2013, he had 40 witnesses appear in front of former members of Congress. There was a sense of American imperialism over the whole UFO secrecy field. There was our presence that would invade other countries to get these downcraft, despite, you know, governments not wanting that. So there, it's very complex and insidious in some ways.
It's very complex. It's very complex. And, you know, again, I think that, you know, there is an intense interest in within our government, particularly within the intelligence agencies, for gathering this advanced technology and using it to enhance our own military posture. And some people might say, well, what's wrong with that? I think that, like you say, I think that the truth here needs to come out. I think the truth needs to be told. And, you know, I see more and more political figures beginning to speak out on this particular issue. And I remember right after, and you probably do too, Alan, right after the triangle craft sightings in Phoenix, the governor of Arizona called for a full-blown investigation.
Yeah, Fife Symington, absolutely.
Governor Fife Symington, who had actually witnessed these craft. And, you know, as they say, seeing is believing. And he wanted answers. He wanted answers from the government. You know, you've got a sitting governor of a state, you know, asking the intelligence services and the government in Washington, D.C., for an explanation of this sighting, these encounters, and in fact, demanding it. But getting nothing, Alan.
I know. Going back before that, also in Arizona, Barry Goldwater, he is a Republican. He actually ran against Johnson in 64, but he got interested in the UFO secrecy, and he went to generals and to military people and said, tell me about it. And they said, no, you're not cleared to hear about this. He got very frustrated. He was really involved in researching it, and he got no answers to his questions. So there's a history of this cover-up. Of course, there's things like Project Blue Book or Project Grudge, where they're documented government agencies, MJ-12 were these agencies that we really don't know that much about, but were formed to really, I think, keep the secret and not to reveal it. So,
well,
there's,
Alan, along those lines, there's an interesting new book that just came out, and it's written by Michael Sala, PhD, in my opinion, one of the best researchers in this field. And the book is about the relationship between President Eisenhower and President Kennedy, and about President Eisenhower's experience with the S-4 area, which is over near Area 51. And, you know, here we have a sitting president who is the commanding general of all U.S. forces trying to get answers about what's going on in S-4 and being stonewalled. And so finally, he got to a point where he said to the people who were responsible for overseeing this, basically he said, look, either you tell me exactly what's going on and thoroughly brief the military person that I'm going to send over there, or I'm going to put together a regimen of military forces, and I'm going to come down there and storm it and find out what's going on. And so finally, they, I guess you could say the MJ-12, saw this as a credible threat. And so they relented and allowed Eisenhower access to this super secret S-4 facility, which, you know, apparently is a repository for UFO information. And so then the question became, okay, well, you know, that happened. Okay, that's a documented fact. So then the question becomes, how did he transfer that information, or did he transfer that information to JFK? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. And so because
JFK... How is the answer yes? What proof is that JFK knew that?
There's a number of documents, and I would have to pull up the book because I read it about a month ago. But Michael Sella does a wonderful job of documenting this transfer of knowledge from Eisenhower to Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So now Kennedy used to be in naval intelligence, and he was aide to James Forrestal, who, as you know, was Secretary of Defense during that period of time. And so what happened was that Forrestal had pretty much briefed Kennedy on the UFO phenomenon, what was going on with that. So he had that even before he came into the presidency. And then apparently what happened is that Eisenhower briefed Kennedy when he came into office. And, you know, Kennedy had a real fascination, some might say an obsession, he and his brother, with finding out, you know, what was going on with this phenomenon. And there are a lot of people who speculate that one of the reasons that Kennedy may have been assassinated is that he was on the verge of disclosing the fact that there had been extraterrestrial influence, you know, in America and in the defense establishment for a long time, and he was about to blow the whistle on that. And a lot of people within the intelligence communities and the military people who comprise the sort of leadership that oversees the S-4 compound took umbrage to that, and it's one of the things that contributed to his eventual assassination.
Well, yeah, and well, that goes along with what a lot of people say, that if there's UFOs and the government knows it, it's impossible for the government to keep a secret like this. But, you know, obviously it is possible because we still don't know who killed Kennedy. You know, it's the government has a lot of secrets they're not telling the American people. And I don't know if it's their own corporate greed or they think we're not ready for this, but I feel like a gathering like this shows that people are ready and that, you know, change is inevitable and it has to happen. And this, above all, is the next phase of our evolution as a planetary civilization. What the acknowledgement of ETs really does is bring us together as a cohesive humanity, or I think that's the hope of it. And what that also does is take down the barriers between countries. It shows we're really one people on one planet. And I think that's part of the resistance on political, you know, leaders.
Well, you know, Alan, I agree with you. I think we are one people. We are one humanity. And I think that it all goes back to the documentation that Sitchin put together of the creation of us as a race, you know, initially as a slave race, and then eventually, you know, left on our own to forge a civilization and a consciousness that is a mature civilization. It's interesting that Sitchin believed that in the beginning that the Anunnaki created a lot of DNA splicing experiments, and after a long series of trials and errors, you know, came out with us, and that his laboratory was in fact somewhere in South Africa. And Michael Tellinger talks about this a lot, and believes, he's one of our speakers, by the way, Alan, who believes that he has found their laboratory, the original laboratory where this one particular scientist of the Anunnaki by the name of Enki did his experiments. And, you know, when I first read that, I was a little bit skeptical. But then I saw this DVD that was produced by the National Geographic Society, believe it or not. And the name of it is called The Genographic. And what the Genographic does is, using mitochondrial DNA, has traced all of the major races and civilizations of the world back to this one spot in South Africa, which, by the way, is coincidental with where Tellinger believes that Encke's original laboratory was, and where Sitchin has documented the location of the original laboratory based on the clay tablets that have been unearthed, many of them 7,000 and 8,000 years old. And so I find that this is fascinating. When I saw this documentary that National Geographic had done, and what a thorough and remarkable job they had done with it, it lent credibility to me to the fact that there was, in fact, a point of origin for humanity, and that we did, in fact, all spring from the same place, and as a result of climate and other external factors, you know, we've developed a number of different races, and those races are really all part of the same humanity, all from the same common root.
Right, I agree with that. And Sitchin also proved somewhere, I read some in an article he wrote, that there's 2% of our DNA that we cannot find the origins of. It's not like anything else on planet Earth, just that 2%. And maybe that's all we're needed. But we are vastly different than all the other animals on the planet. First of all, we're the only ones to look up at the stars and wonder about them. And, you know, I don't agree with everything Sitchin says, because I don't think it was just a slave race. I think there was a purposeful planting of this seed of the divine or of the gods in us to help us evolve. And so I think it wasn't just for the slave race. Of course, there's that discussion in his books about Enki and his brother Enlil, and that I haven't read all the books. I'm sure you've read more of them than me, but I think there was a more of a positive spin to the hybridization of ancient humanity.
Well, you know, I want to look at the brightest possibility, and I do think that, you know, a lot of our purpose here on Earth is to evolve as a species and to evolve spiritually and eventually be able to touch the non-physical sources that are, in fact, our source. But I want to say, too, Alan, that you were talking about the 2% of DNA that we have that no other species has. That's true. And there's also the issue of, where's the missing link between Neanderthal and who we are today? They've never found that, you know, and a lot of people like to kind of gloss that over and say, well, if we dig long enough, sooner or later, we'll find that missing link. But guess what? You know, here we are in 2015. Nobody's found it. And the question is, you know, how did we make that evolutionary leap?
Yeah.
And, you know, the Sitchin thesis is that it was made because we were hybridized, that our genes were manipulated, that we were genetically manipulated to be the species we are today, which is part primitive man who was already here and part Anunnaki. I mean, that's one thesis. And you know, do I take it as gospel? No. But I think that there's enough evidence that it should be looked into in a very serious way. And I kind of applaud Sitchin and von Daniken and Giorgio Tsoukalos for taking that on. David Chilton,
Hatches.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, David Hatches, Chilton. Yeah, I know.
Hatcher, Childer.
Yeah.
I never get all three names right. But yeah, right. He's a frequent guest and researcher on ancient aliens. And for those of your listeners who don't know what that program is, it's on the History Channel, on the H2 History Channel. And I would say almost daily they show episodes of Ancient Aliens, because there is such an intense interest in this, because I think at a racial cellular level there's a remembrance that we are, in fact, connected to this process that Sitchin talks about.
Well, I think that's why we're in such exciting times, and why this event, Contact in the Desert, is probably the largest gathering of researchers and people are interested, because this is a time of awakening, I feel, to those ancient memories, to our origins. As this seems like a veil is being lifted off of the consciousness and the sort of old story we've been fed, and people are truly curious about, you know, their origins and where we're going. You know, we can't trust government to lead us into more wars or more conflict. There's a bigger picture here, and I feel connecting to a larger environment, the galaxy, other civilizations, is a great healing for planet Earth and us. I just feel it's our destiny.
Well, I think that there are more factors unseen that are influencing events on this planet and our own evolution than are being talked about or made known. And so that's a whole nother discipline. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, which I'm not going to broach right at this moment. But, you know, we've also got phenomena that are readily visible, like crop circles, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people say, well, some of them are hoaxes and, you know.
Oh, I've been in the crop circles, and they are amazing, Paul. You feel a vibration. I was obsessed with that. I went to England twice to stand in the crop circles, and yeah, there were some that are hoaxes, but if only one of these amazing complex designs are real, we have communication with a higher intelligence that is giving us fractal patterns to expand our mind. That's how I see it, you know.
Well, absolutely. I mean, these things don't just, these are incredibly complex geometric forms that are suddenly springing up overnight. I mean, truly complex forms. And, you know, there's no power that I know of on Earth that they can create these in such a short time. And I think that is a part of the so-called UFO phenomenon that needs to be continue to be researched and looked into. And I mean, it's something that just really can't be ignored because it's there. I mean, people can look at it, they can go and see it and judge for themselves whether this is real, is it significant, who's doing it, why are they doing it, and what does it mean? You know, these are all questions that Contact in the Desert attempts to answer and look into. And one of the things I like about Contact, Alan, as opposed to many of the other shows that I've been to, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but I think that the faculty, if you will, that we have at this particular show is one of the most credible and well-read and well-researched group of people that I've ever seen at a show. And I know Victoria and I are very, my partner Victoria and I are very proud of that roster. And, well, you know, when I go to the show, Alan, I'm excited about it. You know, even though I'm working, I'm still in there listening to all the talks.
Of course, you're one of us, Paul. You're the reason you're doing this, I feel, and we can get then to that a little later, is because, you know, somehow you're connected to this. It's more than just curiosity. I think there's answers here for you and stuff that may have, you know, happened to you. I don't know what your history is, but I know people that are drawn to this, there's a deeper connection. But just as far as the you know, the faculty here, we have to talk about Edgar Mitchell, who was a sixth man to walk on the moon. Mm-hmm. And I've met Edgar Mitchell. He's very much into exposing the secrets about UFOs and ETs. He's never seen an ET or a UFO, but he has talked to many people about it. You know, he grew up in Roswell, New Mexico, and the old timers used to talk about the craft and building the little coffins to house the bodies. And so he's very much aware of this cover-up. But the other thing that Edgar Mitchell is known for is founding the Institute of Noetic Science. And you know about that, right?
Because I do. But it's worth mentioning, Alan.
Yeah, because on the way back to the moon, he was driving the rover on the surface of the moon. But on the way back, he didn't have much to do except look out the window as the capsule of the the craft was spinning and seeing the earth. And he had an epiphany, almost like a spiritual experience, where he saw that singularity of our native world. And there was a breakthrough, there was an opening on him from a scientist to a mystic. He had a realization of consciousness. And so he devoted the rest of his life after coming back to the moon to understanding consciousness as a science, as a spiritual science. And this Institute of Noetic Science is devoted to the interface between the inner worlds and the outer worlds. That's how I see it. I mean, how could you make that a little clearer?
Well, I think you've done a great job of making it clear. I agree with you that he had an epiphany on the way back. He realized that the little blue ball that we all live on is part of a much larger cosmos and a much larger consciousness. And I think that Noetic Sciences has done fantastic work in terms of bridging the gap between science and human consciousness. And I think Edgar Mitchell speaks eloquently to that issue in a way that I haven't heard many scientists do. Now, in addition to Edgar Mitchell, we also have Story Musgrave, who is also an astronaut.
Yeah, what's the thing? I don't really know his name that well. I mean, so what can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's an astronaut. You know, he's been in space many times. When he speaks publicly in his lecture, you know, he talks a lot about his experiences and so forth in a public way, but then privately, and people will have the opportunity to meet him privately in his workshop, he talks about some of the deeper issues that you and I have been discussing. And, you know, he's, I believe, almost 80 years old now, and a remarkably articulate, interesting gentleman, and I think people enjoy listening to him and meeting him. Mm. I think that one of the other people that I find perennially interesting is Jim Mars. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah, no, I've heard him a couple of times at Contact. I interviewed him a couple of times. Very knowledgeable person about conspiracies, cover-up, governments. I mean, he makes it sound so credible. It's like there's no argument there, you know?
Well, I think he's done his homework. I think mm-hmm. he's done his homework, Alan.
Yeah,
and it was actually from Jim Mars that I originally, many, many years ago, stumbled across the writings of about a dozen different people, Sitchin among them, about this hidden history of our civilization, hidden history, I guess you might say, of America. And he raises the question of, well, if in fact there were these advanced beings who created us and have been guiding us, you know, as we evolve politically and technologically, the question is, what kind of influence do they continue to have on the body politic, on technology, on our military posture, and in fact on our whole philosophy, political philosophy? Right. And I think that he's done a terrific job of tying in some of this research into ancient aliens and the current political situation that we're experiencing today. And for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he's written an excellent book on the relationship between those two things called Rule by Secrecy. Mm-hmm. And Alan, the last quarter of his book, the last 25% of his book, is devoted to many of these researchers and authors who have gone back into these archaeological findings, these clay tablets, and really taken a hard look at them and wrote about what these tablets were saying. And what they all said in many different languages at many different times is that, you know, and as the Bible says, you know, there were at that, you know, back then, at that time, the Nephilim, and there were giants, you know, across the earth, and you know, those giants, he believes, and many other writers believe, were the Anunnaki, this race that came from, supposedly from the planet Nibiru. I'm not convinced of that, but let's say someplace from within the Sirius star system came to our planet and founded, you know, what's essentially our civilization. And he has done a fascinating study on the relationship between these ancient civilizations and who we are today and the political posture that we've assumed today.
Right. And I agree with Jim. There's a direct relationship. And some people actually bring up the idea of these archons. Maybe they're another name for the Nibiru or the Anunnaki, which are still controlling our thoughts. We have been made into materialistic-based creatures that have forgotten the essence of our soul and in a way disconnected from the earth itself. So some people say we've been taken over, our minds have been taken over by this consciousness that has kept us from who we really are, as in a sense still a slave race. Still a slave race, because there's these forces that don't want us to gain the power of our own sovereign nature. And
Well, yes, you're right. And they don't want us to evolve spiritually. And
yes.
There's actually another book that I want to alert your listeners to. Yes. It's written by a fellow by the name of Gerald Clark, and it's called The Anunnaki of Nibiru. And in it, he talks about the relationship between things discussed in the Vedic text, you know, the seven chakras, and how one of our missions as spiritual beings in the material world is to open up these chakras and reinvigorate them so that they allow us to have direct spiritual knowledge of a higher power. And his whole book is based on the relationship, once again, between these ancient alien races and who we are and who we've become and how we were genetically manipulated to be the race that we are today. It's a fascinating book. It's called The Anunnaki of Nibiru. And that's written by Gerald Clark.
But you realize what you're saying here, if these books are true, and they probably are on some level, this affects religion, people's belief system. A lot of people are so conditioned. I mean, we see it all the time in these fundamentalist actions to believe just what they've been brainwashed, conditioned to think is true. And what we're discussing here really goes against the very nature of people's conditioning, and it's a challenge.
It does. It's. I feel that this event that we're doing and this whole UFO question, you know, begs us to wake up to you know, some of these things that are going on, and try to understand how it's affecting us, because a lot of people, you know, they've been conditioned to poo-poo the UFO field. Oh, that's just, you know, a bunch of crazy people getting together out in the desert, and you know, it has no meaning in my life. And you know, if it really was significant, the government would have acknowledged it and talked about it. And I think that there are reasons why this has not been disclosed. And you've talked about Stephen Bassett, who's coming to our show, but also Stephen Greer, you know, who held the original Disclosure Project in Washington, D.C., that talked about the necessity of having full disclosure for this field and what it means to us to wake up to the fact that there's something major going on here that profoundly affects all of us.
Well, I agree. It does affect all of us in ways that we're not even aware of. So, what were you saying then?
Well, I was going to lead into that and talk a little bit about one of the political figures who I think has had a lot of courage speaking out about this particular topic. And, you know, of course, we have Jimmy Carter, but most recently we have John Podesta. And John Podesta was chief of staff for Bill Clinton for several years during his presidency. And is currently a senior advisor in the Obama administration. and soon to be the campaign chairman of Hillary Clinton's campaign for president.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a guy who is on the inside of the inside. And right. If you Google him or you go to YouTube, you will find snippets of him talking about his belief that there is a need for disclosure. And what's interesting to me is that one of the wealthiest people in America at the time, Lawrence Rockefeller, was a proponent of disclosure. And in fact, was the person who financed Daniel Sheehan, another one of our speakers,
right,
to defend Dr. John Mack, who had written a number of books about abduction, who was a professor at Harvard University.
Well, not only was he a professor, he was a professor of psychiatry. He was a doctor of psychiatry that taught psychiatry at Harvard. And when he came out with the book called Abductions, Harvard said, "You can't say that. This is making us look bad." And he goes, "Well, this is true. This is happening to people." And Harvard threatened to fire him. And Danny Sheehan came in as his defense counsel. And they couldn't continue the case. So Danny Sheehan and John Mack hold major positions in this field. But yeah, getting back to Lawrence Rockefeller, was very much in support of John Mack coming forward and sharing this.
Very much so. And in fact, Alan, I know that you'll remember that he invited the Clintons out to his estate, I believe it was in Montana,
and
gave them a briefing book that he had compiled from the Disclosure Project, giving all the information that he had about the UFO phenomenon. And it's perplexing to me that Bill Clinton has continued to deny that he knows anything about this. And when, in fact, one of Webster Hubble's original mandates from him was to go in and find out two things once he took office: who killed John Kennedy and where are the UFOs? I mean, that was his mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you that after 8 years in his presidency, that he found out a great deal about both of these subjects. And
right, but they were both very threatening. I mean, I don't know. Do you think he found out who killed Kennedy? I do.
But I think that he had enough of his own weaknesses, problems, that he was able to be threatened to the point where they said, "Look, you know, either you go along with the agenda, or we're going to, you know, destroy your presidency." And I think that he was faced with a Hobbesian choice, and he chose to continue to live and have a good life and be there for his daughter's wedding, and he chose that over disclosure.
Well, it could be.
And continues to choose it.
Well, it could be, though, that Hillary, as Stephen Bassett would say, could be the disclosure president. I met her once, and, you know, she's very conservative. She's actually more conservative politically than Bill Clinton, but I did sense, and this is just my, you know, tuning in, that there was this field around her that she was on a greater mission, and who knows, but I think if it's going to happen, and it's likely that some sort of formal disclosure could happen in the next 8 years, I would think.
Well, you know, I'd like to think that, Alan. I'd like to think that, but I'm not so sure. You know, I go back to what you were saying originally. Can the government truly keep a secret? Well, I think they can.
Well,
and I think that, you know, the forces that are keeping this covered up are not going to be eager to come forward and disclose it. In fact, I was at a conference and I asked George Norrie publicly if he thought that we would ever see disclosure in our lifetime. And this is a person who knows a lot, as you and I both know. And he said, he reflected on it for a moment, and he said, "No, I don't believe we will."
Well, I'd rather talk to people like Grant Cameron about that. I mean, George is great, and he's going to be there, and he's the most popular talk show host in America for sure. Mm-hmm. But Grant Cameron, you know his work, he researches presidents after president and their connection to the UFO situation. He's one of, for me, the along with you know, Richard Dolenz, Linda Moulton-Howe, Grant Cameron is probably one of the top researchers in the world in this field.
Let's talk about why you feel that way, Alan.
Well, he it's not about belief for Grant or Cameron. He goes in and looks at the documentation that each of these presidents are associated with in relationship to the UFO. He has a, I think it's called White House UFO is his website. And he doesn't say that disclosure is closed, but he's been following the situation. I mean, including that story with Richard Nixon showing Jackie Gleason the bodies to these ET beings. I mean, there's no reason for Jackie Gleason's wife or him to make something like that up. It looks ridiculous, except the fact that, you know, it might be true. So Grant, I think, is some person, as a person who goes into really detailed analysis of each presidential legacy and their relationship to the UFOs. And it seems like, I mean, I don't know if he says this, but we're building towards something. I mean, we're, and Podesta, I think, is part of it, and having Clinton publicly deny this and having Obama go on the Jimmy Kimmel show. Did you see that recently?
I did. It was fascinating. And, you know, they have it up on YouTube, and I would encourage your listeners to go up there and watch it. And where Jimmy Kimmel asked them about the phenomenon, and he said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing now, that he's not supposed to talk about that.
He actually says, and you know, the interesting thing about that interview, if you read the transcripts without watching the videotape, there's a sense of a formal acknowledgement. He says the aliens won't let us happen. But watching the videotape, he makes a joke of it, but, you know, it seems like it's not just a joke. Something, I mean, they're laughing and say, oh, yeah, the aliens won't let me talk about this. I mean, but what's really going on here? I mean, it's like all politicians, in a sense, they say one thing, but they're really meaning something else. It's very subtle, and I think the movement towards this disclosing this secret is a slow leak, and it's been very minutely mapped out to possibly, and this is my theory, to cause the least amount of damage to the structures that currently exist. That's what I get from it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, you know, again, I want to refer you to this book that was written by Michael Sellen. I don't have it in front of me, but the entire book is all about the relationship between Dwight Eisenhower to the alien phenomenon, and then in turn John F. Kennedy to the alien phenomenon. And he's done a marvelous job of documenting that. And I know right now he's trying to raise money through crowdfunding to turn it into a film. And so if any of you listening are interested in helping that to happen, you may want to go and Google and find out more about that. That's Dr. Michael Sella.
Right. You know, what I think is also interesting is that the people coming to this conference, the speakers, and anyone coming there, if they were not, let's call them a believer or aware of the truth about this, would be convinced, I think, after listening to these speakers that you have here relay their hard earned research, or, you know, the sincerity of their testimony. People like Travis Walton. I was just with Travis Walton in New York. I just presented his latest documentary. That's somebody who spent 5 days confirmed, I mean, witness testimony, 5 days aboard an alien spacecraft. It's probably the most phenomenal case out there. And there's no doubt. I mean, this guy is not doing it for the money or the fame. He's a shy guy. He was a logger. There's no reason him or his crew of six that were with him that saw him get blasted, that were then accused of murdering him and hiding the body, but passed lie detector tests, would be making this story up. I mean,
right,
And the integrity and the sincerity and him willing to come forth after year and saying, this is my truth, this is what happened to me, is so convincing.
Well, it is convincing. He's a very sincere guy. I've known him for years and years. And, he just wants to tell his story. He wants people to know that, you know, this has happened to him and maybe it's happened to you. And if it's happened to you, then you're not alone. And by the way, as you know, Alan, there was a movie made about it called Fire in the Sky.
Right.
I believe Julia Roberts' brother starred in that. It's been so long since I've seen it, but it was actually a well-done film.
It was well done, but he had some issue with it, so he made this documentary called Travis.
Mm-hmm. He felt that the movie didn't tell the whole story, that they left out a lot of key parts. And I guess that's why he made the documentary.
Yes. And this documentary will be shown. I think I just saw that on the schedule at Contact in the Desert.
It will be shown at Contact in the Desert in Joshua Tree, May 29th through June 1st.
Yes, and you can go to contactinthedesert.com for tickets and all the information that you need to know about speakers and dates and times and accommodations.
Accommodations, everything. And for those of you who are not particularly comfortable or conversant with the internet, there's a phone number that you can call and talk to a live person and get help registering or get information that you need that maybe you didn't see on the website. Mm-hmm. And that number, Alan, is 760-365-8371.
Well, this has been great, Paul. I mean, we don't have to go, but I do want to ask you one more question. Is that, why are you so interested in it? I mean, have you had a person? I mean, what was it in your experience that, you know, woke you up to this, to the fact that this could be a possibility?
Well, there's a number of things, but I will share with you one particular thing that goes deep into my childhood. I had an older sister, is about a year and a half older than me, and she and I used to have, our bedrooms were next to each other. And I remember going into her room one night and seeing these, she called them sandmen, in there that were in a room like nothing I had ever seen before. And, they were kind of sitting there talking to her. And then when I came in, started talking to me. And I really had to struggle to remember this incident. And apparently it happened more than once. And when we were young, my sister used to talk to me about it. But then as we got older, I, gradually forgot about it. But, obviously there's been some contact there.
Did she remember it? Does she talk about it now?
She remembered it better than I did. And unfortunately, she died about 7 years ago. And so, I've begun to remember more and more of it. And I guess that, I would have to say that is the basis for, this deep and abiding interest in this field. Now, I will say, too, that my father was intensely interested in this also. And so I believe that contact is generational. In other words, if you've had contact, there's a good chance that one of your parents have, or your grandparents have, or your great-grandparents have. And in fact, I have another relative in the Andrews line who is at Yale University, teaches at Yale University, who is intensely interested in this because he's had contact. And so I think that it's something that is generational and that has been in my family for quite a long time.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I didn't know that about you, but I knew there was a passion for this that seemed to stem from some kind of personal experience, because I think a lot of people who come to this conference really want answers, or like you said, confirmation that from others that something real is happening here. Because
right. I agree, Alan. I think that people who have had experiences want answers, and they I think a lot of people who don't have a frame of reference to put it in, I can, from my own experience, I can tell you that it must be it must be profoundly perplexing and puzzling and disturbing.
Well, there's a woman coming from Australia. I was just in Australia. I told her about contact. She signed up. She's coming. She had an amazing sighting and witnessing where she was outside with a number of people in the pool. There was a swimming pool nearby, and the pool started to get fluorescence, like it started to bubble for no reason. And then she saw this craft in the field she was in front of start to materialize, started to slowly come into form, and she and everyone was just blown away. I mean, that was an experience that, who do you talk to about that, you know?
Right, and who's going to believe you?
Right, but I believed her because it's like, it's not the first time I've heard that. So, you know, this is a woman in Australia, but I've heard it from people in the Midwest. I've heard it from people in Washington State. I mean, there's a commonality and a science and a sort of validation that I feel happens when we compare stories and look for patterns of contact that seem unique, but they're really not. And I think ultimately this will be some sort of social science, the understanding of this phenomena. I think contact is the beginning of that movement.
I feel that way. I feel that it's a multidisciplinary subject that needs to be approached in an academic and scientific way, and that is the way we've structured our show, Alan. I've tried to bring in credible people who have done deep research, who, you know, believe with all their heart that there's something amazing going on here that is not readily apparent and for reasons that we don't understand has been hidden.
Right. And it's also very, very exciting that we are at the forefront of something new, of new ideas entering the collective field. There's a movement in the consciousness to acknowledge this phenomena. And for me, I can't think of a more exciting field to be a part of.
Well, let me say this, Alan, and to you and your listeners, and we haven't even announced this yet, so you're really the first people to hear about it. But there is actually a sitting congressman who is coming to the show and is going to serve on one of my panels, and he doesn't want us to share his name at this point because he's afraid of the pressure that would be brought upon him to not participate, and so we have to hold off until right before the show to announce it. But I just found this out today. And, you know, when you begin to have people who are politically responsible beginning to take a very serious look at this phenomenon, it's encouraging to me that, like Grant Cameron, maybe we can finally have some kind of meaningful disclosure.
Well, that's exciting. Thanks for sharing that here. And I think that ups the whole scale of what's possible collectively, and that kind of acknowledging that, well, I'm going to check this out, I'm going to consider this, along with John Podesta, along with so many people that are doing, you know, the work from bringing those secrets out. Nick Pope, who worked for the Ministry of Defense in the British, in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. So he'll be there. And
he'll be there, too.
Mm-hmm. And so, thank you. And I'll be emceeing one of the stages there.
One of our stellar MCs, and somebody who's been a supporter and with Contact in the Desert from the very beginning, and one of the people that has been instrumental in forming the program and contributing to its continuity. So I want to acknowledge you for that, Alan, and thank you.
Well, thanks, Paul. Really, like I said, I cannot think of something more exciting to be a part of than this movement and this global awakening. It's might be compared to what I think, like the civil rights movement in the early '60s, or the women's movement, or any of those social movements that that started slow, and there was oppression and suppression, and slowly there was a momentum being built. And, like, you know, right now marijuana is legal in so many states. Not that I'm an advocate of that, but there was a, you know, it was very...
It was a movement that was slow and a long time coming. And I found it encouraging that Oregon, you know, is the most recent state to adopt legalization. But your point is well taken. You know, I think that this is starting out really slow, and I think that, you know, the fact that we're taking a scientific and academic approach to it and showing people that this is a serious subject with many different disciplines associated with it, that it will build and that it will shift consciousness in a way, perhaps in a hundredth monkey way, that allows it to be a legitimate part of the national discussion.
Right, and part of a worldwide global change, like the way Copernicus said, you know, guess what? The Earth isn't the center of the universe. What that did as a byproduct was open an age of exploration and thinking in new ways about who we are, who we were as a civilization. I think this kind of acknowledgement will do the same thing. It'll ignite a new creativity and a new understanding of what the human being is, and that may include some of the stuff we talked about with the Anunnaki. But there's a potential for change, and really, change is what we need at this point in history, probably now more than ever. So, thanks.
Well, I agree with you, Alan. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And so, hopefully that this event will trigger or ignite that conversation in a way that is transformational.
Well, I just want to also acknowledge you, Paul, for really being there in the early stages of the consciousness movement with the, you know, the Whole Life Expo, and you've tracked this thing in a way since its modern inception. What do you say about the change you've seen in people over the last probably 40 years?
Well, I think as you pointed out, we've gone through a significant evolution about this subject. I mean, you know, when you go back to the, you know, the early 40s or even before that, there was practically no conversation about any of this. And now here we are at 2015, and, you know, I think outside of the sex sites that there's more UFO sites on the Internet than almost anything else. And I think that there is an awakening to the fact that this phenomenon is real, that it's multidisciplinary, that it's having an effect on our everyday lives, and that it's something that we need to take seriously and look at. And so for me, the evolution has gone from, you know, the earliest days when, you know, somebody coined the term of flying saucers, and, you know, what I see is a long history of projects to debunk the reality of this phenomenon. And to the point where we've got some very serious people who are in positions of authority and responsibility talking openly about this. And, you know, we've covered a number of them. I believe absolutely in my heart that Dwight Eisenhower knew everything that there was to know about this phenomenon. I think that he transmitted it to JFK. Mm-hmm. I think that Nixon was fully aware of it, obviously, as you've pointed out, that he, you know, took Jackie Gleason and his wife to see these aliens. And then, you know, following Nixon, we had Jimmy Carter, you know, who absolutely believed in the reality of UFOs. In fact, I can't remember all the details of his experience, but I know that he had a profound experience. And, you know, we just keep on moving, you know, through the different administrations. You know, I had hoped that, you know, the Clinton administration would be more of a disclosure, but it hasn't been. You know, perhaps Barack Obama in the last year of his presidency might be the disclosure president. Maybe it's Hillary Clinton. I don't know, Alan. But what I do know is that there's a lot more people interested in this and talking about it than there ever were when I was, you know, a teenager or a young person. I believe it has evolved. Don't you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. But I was also asking about the whole spiritual landscape when you start. I mean, that's a huge shift from when you first started. And of course, UFOs are part of it, but it's within a bigger context of people waking up. So just if you want to just touch on, you know, the fact that when you started the Whole Life Expos back, I guess it was in the 70s, you know, what the change is in the collective movement of consciousness as you see it.
Well, that's an interesting, you know, that's an interesting conversation. And I mean, it has evolved dramatically from when I first started. I think when I first started, there were a lot of people who had near-death experiences in that they had died, gone someplace remarkable that seemed to them like heaven, and came back to talk about it. And I think that one of the reasons that there was a proliferation of that kind of conversation is because the technology that we had developed allowed us to bring back more people from the dead, if you will, and right. In a way that they could, you know, continue to talk about it. And we saw Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Robert Monroe, who were pioneers in this subject matter. Raymond Moody, right. You know, who wrote the book Life After Life, from a doctor's perspective, talking to these people who had died, stayed dead, some of them for as much as 10 minutes, and come back and were able to talk about what had happened to them, where they went, how they transcended physical matter reality and went into a place where they were profoundly expanded in consciousness and deeply connected to what they felt was the spiritual source or God, and that they met dead relatives there, that, you know, there was incredibly beautiful music, that there were incredibly beautiful scenes that they saw that were unearthly, that were non-physical, that were part of a higher, more expanded spiritual reality. And so I think what really opened the door for this conversation to continue were people like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Raymond Moody, and frankly, Shirley MacLaine. You know, she was a pioneer, is a pioneer in the consciousness movement. And to me, the root of that movement is that we are, in fact, more than our physical body, that we are spiritual beings inhabiting a physical body in physical matter reality, and that eventually we will all transcend this physical matter reality we are in into a much larger spiritual reality, which is, I believe, our true home. And so for me, those pioneers who began talking about that, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, Charles Tart is another one that I can think of who, you know, wrote a lot of the early books, you know, based on their research and their experience, kind of laid the groundwork for the current consciousness field that we're all involved in and experiencing today. And yes, you're right, the Whole Life Expo was the premier event that showcased many of these authors and speakers, especially early on.
Well, and you know what? I mean, yes, thank you for relaying that history, but I also see what started as a fringe movement back in the 70s now seems to be not fringe at all. I mean, near-death experiences, I mean, Oprah's doing shows about this, best-selling books. Anita Mirjani, if you want to read an amazing near-death experience, her book, Dying to Be Me, is probably the best I've seen and read on that subject. And so I think
along those lines, Alan, not to interrupt you.
Yeah, yeah.
But Anita Mirjani, along with Evan Alexander and Raymond Moody and about a dozen of the other top researchers into life after life and near-death experiences, will be here in Los Angeles November 2021-22. There will be a conference called Heaven Can Wait, Life After Life. Mm-hmm. And that is being done by the same production group that is doing Contact in the Desert.
Right. And that's so exciting.
That's exciting, and you know, of course, we're counting on you to be part of that.
Well, and I love it. You know, yeah, this is, you know, I mean, we're part of it. I mean, thank you, Paul. But we're part of it anyway. It's like it's something in a way bigger than us that's going on. That's driving this.
Absolutely, absolutely, and. You know, I think that, you know, our greatest task as human beings walking in the physical world today is to open ourselves up into the full potential of our own spiritual reality. And maybe that means clearing the seven chakras so that we can be more expanded, compassionate, loving people, be more in communion with our Creator, with the ultimate spiritual reality. I mean, I think that that's our highest purpose here on Earth. And I think that there are a lot of people moving towards that, and particularly here in America, where we have so much affluence and we have the free time to be able to pursue these things. Of course, some people would argue that a lot of the most advanced spiritual work that's being done on the planet is being done in India. And India, as you and I both know, is one of the poorest countries in the earth, on Earth. I mean,
I think Indian spirituality, and just in my opinion, is about the old paradigm. It's about guru worships. It's about, you know, partly that place is so overpopulated and polluted because they're not, and this is, of course, just what I see, there's not a value in being really present on Earth, because it's always about the afterlife and karma. And I think we have to make spirituality practical. It has to be important for who we are right now. And you know, India,
to make it contemporary, to make it an important part of our evolution, you know, culturally, financially, technologically, yes. Absolutely. But I, you know, I have to say that, you know, there, you know, maybe India is a bad example. Maybe maybe some of the Buddhist cultures that I've come in contact with are another good example. I do think that there are spiritual movements within India that are advanced way beyond what is discussed here in Western culture.
Well, no, you're right. And I think actually with your Prana Fest and with other festivals like that, Bhakti and all these, well, you could talk about Prana. You are taking the best of Indian spirituality and showing people in this country what's possible. If you just want to mention that briefly, you know, you can. What's
Alan? I love being on your show. You touch on all my events.
Well, you know, I'm support you, Paul. I like what you're doing, so why not?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I agree with you. You know, I think that Prana Fest is a nod to higher spirituality, and I think that a lot of the techniques that have come down to us through the Vedic writings are applicable in our own spiritual growth today. And I think that it's certainly possible for us to take the best elements of all the traditional religions and find the ones that resonate for us, the ones that work for us. And I think that that's a worthy undertaking and an important undertaking.
So when is Prana Fest happening?
Prana Fest typically happens in August in a little town called Ashland, Oregon, in the southern part of Oregon, considered to be the metaphysical capital of the West Coast, and that's where we hold it.
Great. Well, I look forward to that too. So, well, thank you, Paul. I'm really excited about Contact coming up again. Contact in the Desert. That's May 29th to June 1st in Joshua Tree, California. You can go to contactinthedesert.com. And what, 40 speakers are there coming this year? 40?
46 speakers, and then we just added the congressman today, so I guess we have to say 47.
Right, and films, and there'll be
films, music. One of the unique things that we do is we have the speakers eat every meal in this general cafeteria with all the people who are attending, so they have an opportunity to sit at a table and you know, talk to Eric Von Daniken, talk to Giorgio Tsoukalos, talk to Travis Walton, talk to Linda Moulton-Howe, people that most people have only seen on television.
Yeah, no, that is great how accessible each of the speakers are, and how, for me, how pleasant the land is out there in Joshua Tree. You know, I've been coming there since 1983. That was the first time I was at the retreat center, and it's just been a sanctuary for me because it just feels very nice. And maybe it's like you talked about the vibration of the land. Is there something about that place that is uplifting? So,
well, it is uplifting. I think it's a spiritual acupressure point, if you will, spiritual vortex. And I think that because it is, for whatever reasons, it's what serves as a magnet for the UFO phenomenon and for a lot of the spiritual traditions, beginning with the Reverend John Dingell, who spent 7 years in Tibet and brought those teachings back to America in the early 1900s. So really the seeds for the Joshua Tree Retreat Center were sown around 1900.
Right. A dingo came there, got this land out, and really must have been the middle of nowhere back then, you know.
Yeah, truly nowhere. But he chose, and we found in his writings, we have a lot of his original writings, many of them are at UCLA, but you know, where he states that the reason he chose that land is because he felt that the veil between the physical and non-physical was very thin there, and that it had high spiritual energy. And that's one of the reasons that he chose it. And, you know, you can feel that, Alan, the minute you step onto that property. I mean, I do every time I step onto it.
I feel really peaceful. I feel really like things are easy. There's less stress. There's something going on in that land that feels really nice for me. That's how I feel.
Well, I feel that way, too. It's 425 acres of bliss, you might say. And you know, the desert nights there are remarkably clear because you don't have the light pollution that you have in the city. So when you go outside and you look up at the heavens, I mean, you can very clearly see the Milky Way. The sky and the stars are bright because you're up high. It's the high desert. You don't have a lot of light pollution. The air is clear there. It's not polluted. It's really just a wonderful spot, and we've deliberately kept all the roads and the pathways and everything, the dirt and sand composition that is found throughout the retreat center. We've kept that so that as people walk around, they're walking in a very grounded way and connected to the spiritual energy that I feel permeates that entire property.
Well, just to add to that, as far as the night sky, the clarity of the night sky, there's going to be night vision glasses out there in the evening, which amplifies the light frequencies hundreds of times. So you could see stars where it looks like empty space, and many people see objects in the sky because of this light amplification. And
Yeah, they do, Alan. In fact, my partner Victoria saw a phenomenon that she simply couldn't explain when she was looking through the night vision goggles. And, you know, because they amplify and dramatically pull closer those lights, if you will, or the ambient light and the specific pinpoints of light that are out there, you begin to see things that you can't see normally with the naked eye. And, you know, we just had a lot of people wowed and excited about things that they had seen that they never thought that they would see in their lives. And there's I don't know, they've got like 40 or 50 night vision goggles, and, you know, we've got, what, maybe, you know, 1,500 people there. So, you know, at some point during the 4 days, there's ample opportunity to go there and look through them. And we have a fella, I can't remember his name, I think it's Ed Grimsley.
Nick
at Nine. And he's the person that's in charge of that particular experience, and one of the many experiences we have there.
Right, so that's what makes this event so much fun. You got the night vision glass, you have incredible discussion, including the panel discussion. So I think it's going to be a really great event. Thank you, Paul, for taking so much time and just really going over in detail what people can expect there.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Alan. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I really look forward to seeing you out on Joshua Tree at the end of May.
Well, Joshua Tree is one of my favorite places, and really, if you're anywhere near the desert out there, Palm Springs, in that part of Southern California, come to Contact in the Desert, May 29th to June 1st. All the information. I think it's a great price. It's affordable to spend.
It's affordable. We've tried to keep it low, and then people can go to the website contactinthedesert.com, and everything you need to know, including the full listing of the speakers and the schedule, is up there.
All right. Thanks, Paul. I've been talking to Paul Andrews, the founder of the Whole Life Expo and Times, and one of the producers of Contact in the Desert. So, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to emceeing the stage and creating a great event that people will find memorable. Really
memorable and experiential, and Alan, I'm so pleased that you're part of it, and I want to thank you again for all the support that you've been to the show.
Thanks, Paul. I'll see you soon. I'll see you in the next couple of weeks.
I will look forward to it, Alan, and thanks again.
Okay, thanks. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and that was Paul Andrews, one of the producers of the upcoming Contact in the Desert. If you have any more questions, you can go to contactinthedesert.com, or you can reach me at my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening tonight. Good night.